I know a number of you have just been served your dessert. Please go ahead and consume it if your diet permits, or if you're being out of town, your diet is on hold, whichever. Well, everything I've heard and seen this morning indicates that we've gotten off to a very good start. We are pleased to have as our luncheon speaker James Boyd White of the University of Michigan, one of the James Whites at Michigan, one of the many James Whites in legal education. I think maybe if you want your child to grow up to be a law teacher, perhaps you might name her or him James. You have to modify, no, change the middle initial and middle name somehow. It seems to have worked. Jim White has a love of language I'm pleased to note, and people I do know who have that kind of love are good writers. I'm pleased that John Ciardi is back, at least on, it seems to me, back on National Public Radio. And of course we have William Sapphire and other columnists that remind us of things. Some of you may have seen a recent cartoon in the Wall Street Journal of the lady teller is holding a note, and there's the hold-up person standing, and she is saying to him, "There is no hyphen in hold-up." Always an editor. We asked Professor White to talk to us about legal writing and literature and the law, giving him a title to a speech that gives him license to talk about everything but tapioca and Tasmania. Jim?
You walked away with my speech here. Yes. Thank you, Miller. I'm going to talk, first of all, if this is too loud or too soft, be sure to tell me. I want to talk about literature and the teaching of legal writing from a perspective that may be somewhat different from those you've been hearing about so far, a perspective which is actually can be found in my book, The Legal Imagination, which I'll be in part describing in what follows. Before I want to talk about the use of literature in teaching legal writing. But before I get to that, I want to say something about the teaching of writing itself, because for me, the first thing to hang on to when I think about teaching legal writing is that we're teaching writing. We're teaching writing. And as an aid to what I want to say about that, I want to put before you what could be two ideal types, one of them positive and one of them negative, of the way in which people learn to write generally. Now, I'm not thinking here so much about law school as I am about college and high school, but I think that what I will say will be familiar to you. One way of teaching students to write, which you could call the imitative way, is teaching them writing as a kind of technology or instrumentality, something distant from themselves, which they will use to attain ends not expressible in the language that they are using, a kind of teaching which is necessarily inauthentic to the individual himself or herself. This is teaching writing as though there were a right way to do it and various wrong ways to do it. And the job of the student is to learn how to do it the right way. And when you've done it the right way, you get an A, you get a gold star, you get rewarded with a smile from the teacher who says, "Isn't it nice you said different from instead of different than." This is the way grammar is taught. This is the way writing is taught from elementary school through college and, for the most part, through law school. One of the characteristics of this kind of teaching is that it's completely divorced from substance. You can imagine a paper getting an A or an A+, the content of which, in a writing course in college or high school, the content of which was completely empty and of no interest either to the teacher or to the student. Because after all, this is not a course in political thinking. This is not a course in ethics. This is not a course in how you want to lead your life. This is a course only in writing, and writing is a technique or a technology. And if we were to, and you are to use it as you see fit, the premise of this kind of teaching is, and in fact, if we got into the merits of what you were saying, that would actually be a little bit inappropriate. This is writing as a way of pleasing others. First your teacher, but then various other readers. And if I'm a composition teacher, then I'm now actually talking about a school of composition teaching in universities, in which suppose you're a freshman or sophomore is taking my composition course. What I say to you is, I'm going to teach you how to write so that you can go off and please your history teacher, your poli-sci teacher, or your other teacher by speaking their language their way, as though that could be divorced from what you're actually saying. This is writing as a way of pleasing others, writing as a way of acquiring power or prestige, writing as a way of claiming prestige, saying, listen to me, I don't say different than, I say different from, or I can lard my prose with quotations from the great authors, which I find in the back of Bartlett's collected quotations, or something like that. This is teaching writing as a version of the kind of teaching in which there are thought to be right answers and wrong answers, right ways to write and wrong ways to write. You learn the right way and you'll be all set. That is, and if I teach perfectly, and you're all my students in my sophomore writing course, when we get through at the end, you'll all write exactly the same way. And my Freudian slip is also accurate. You will, after you graduate and become teachers, all teach exactly the same way. In law school, there is this kind of teaching of writing, and it also affects the substance of what we do. For often, there is the idea, students certainly get it, that if there's a memo assignment, there's one right way to do the memo. And you get graded up or down depending upon whether or not you, how closely you approximate the Platonic ideal of the perfect memo for this particular, or the correct way to state the holding of a case. And obviously, whether this is the correct holding or that is the correct holding is the topic of argument. And what lawyers learn how to do is not how to state the correct holding. What lawyers learn how to do is to argue about whether this or that is the right holding and to make a decision which they're willing to defend. In our law school exams, which is perhaps the most miserable aspect of our common life that we share with our students, this tendency is even more exaggerated. You give one of these exams and you do have a Platonic ideal. Some people have it just in their heads. Other people have checklists, and you say, someone will see that there's this Miranda problem, and did they get the open, and all that kind of stuff, and you find yourself dying bit by bit as you grade the exam. Your students are dying quickly as they write them. In some way, and this is really almost nothing is more symptomatic of what's wrong with legal education than the fact that our examination process is so terrible for them and for us. I'm now sort of on an aside, but not really. Could you imagine giving a law school examination in which there were lots of different good answers? Why not? If you were teaching history, if you were teaching political science, you could do that. Could you imagine giving a law school examination in which you could, to which you could look forward to reading the answers with pleasure? You could imagine that. This kind of writing, in education generally, writing meaning just one manifestation of it, is false in performance and false in satisfaction. The kids learn how to please you. They're, in a sense, conning their teachers. They've been conning their teachers ever since they were little. The teachers have something they want. They're going to give the teachers what they want, so they'll get from the teachers what they want, which is to get promoted and get A's and get into good schools and all that kind of stuff. It fits with a certain vision of life more generally, which is that the object of life is to become like something you're not. What you want to do is to grow up and become like why do you want to be a lawyer, young man or young woman? And you hear people beginning to talk about Hill Street Blues or something like that. You say, oh, Joyce Davenport. You say, well, are you Joyce Davenport? No, but I would like to be like that. Or, say, and in a way, this kind of teaching is teaching people to acquire a social and linguistic uniform. And I remember once I'd been off fishing and drinking beer with my brother for a weekend, and we came back all unshaven to Boston where I was practicing law, and we had lunch in a bar. It was a day off for me. It was Monday, day off for me. We were sitting there complaining about lawyers and our common lot in life in the sort of post-adolescent way we did in those days. And four pale-faced individuals with worried looks came with gray suits, came in, And my brother said, there are four of them now. And there are a lot of law firms which educate their young by the same model, which is there is a Smith, Jones, and White way to do it. And you should learn to do it the Smith, Jones, and White way. And do it means not only write briefs, but interview clients, carry yourself, and even a certain softness of tone, a demean, gently ingratiating demeanor, which goes with a particular law firm style, or perhaps brashness is more it. See, the senior partner wears a rose and lapel. We all wear roses and lapel, that kind of thing. There are other possibilities in law, in legal education, and in law practice. There are lawyers for whom the life of the law is free and expansive, a place where they're discovering their own, that they're exercising, developing their own style and exercising their own capacities and having them develop in new and different ways. There are law firms which prize individuality and variety, not sameness. There may even be law schools that do the same thing, although I'm not going to make that claim or characterization of any of them. This is a training in falseness and in intellectual and political subordination. Oh, well, that's model one. That's bad. If you wanted to know my thought about that. That's good. There is another way of trying, of conceiving of the teaching of writing, which is conceiving of the person you're teaching as a person like you, who has experience that is his or her own, that may or may not have something to say, or some experience, some problem in speech, some way of wanting to modify a relationship with his or her own mind, or with you, or other people. And that on this view, the kind of writing you would hope they and you would attain would be, instead of imitative, would be expressive, authentic to the individual, not the same, different, a way of saying through forms something you want to say, or if saying has some of the wrong implications that I think it does, a way of doing through forms something you want to do. This would be a way of, if this were successful, this kind of writing teaches help somebody to become more completely what they are and what they want to be. Now, teaching in this, of this kind, and this is, I'm still talking about teaching generally, doesn't begin with correctness and propriety and the rightness of the form and different than and different from and learning to have verbs and nouns correlate or something like that. It doesn't begin there at all, at all. What it begins with is where the student is, who the student is, whether or not they have something to say that's problematic really for them in some way. The task of the teacher of this kind of teaching is to create a circumstance in which it's likely that the student will actually find something in life problematic and want to think and write or respond or say or do something about it because the student actually wants to do it. An example of what I do not mean would be an assignment which asks students to write draft letters to their congressman saying what they think about abortion or the death penalty, MX missile or something like that. That's early training in how to be bad lawyers, because what they do is go read the New York Times and clip out all the arguments and see all the pros and the cons and rearrange them just the way we all too often teach people to write briefs. If this kind of teaching were successful, as I say, the result would be increased individuation rather than sameness. The individual would not be repeating sentences learned elsewhere, but actually inventing sentences of his or her own. Instead of feeling controlled by the forces compelling you to imitate others, you would feel in control of them, and you would have a view of your life as increasingly becoming yourself in relation to your language and other people. But how could teaching like this proceed? Composition course for undergraduates, because I don't have time to, but I took what amounts to such a course, which bonafide my whole life, what happened was that I was asked questions to which there was no possible, quote, right answer. There were questions which were disturbing, in which I had to find an answer of my own, and I had to think about what I could say to fill the gap that the questions created and the like. I'm not going to say any more about that now because that's really will be implicit in what I say from now on. The art of this kind of teaching is to create the circumstances where students feel that they have something they want to say, that something is problematic that they want to address or do something about. If you can't give them something, that you can't tell them what they want to say, of course, but you can create sort of benign discomfort maybe a sense that there's a vacuum around them, that they've got to fill, and they're responsible for filling it away in a way that is appropriate to them. Now, how can this be done, as I say, skipping the general question, how can this be done in law school? It's a very difficult problem, because an awful lot of legal education does proceed by the imitative model, and we use that model in order to get our students to be like us, and there are certain efficiencies and values in doing that. You might not be able to give it up entirely in any event. But what could be important, you suppose you have to imagine this law student out there, and you take this idea, the second idea of legal writing as expressive and writing as authentic and expressive, and you say, what can there possibly be that this person cares enough about in common with these other people sitting around the same room so that this could be the subject of real writing? The substance of the law? It's asking an awful lot of a first semester, second semester, third semester law student to care passionately about whether or not the American Law Institute should adopt the wait-and-see rule and rule against perpetuities. Now, if you saw Dickie Powell and Jim Kasner debate that question, you would have seen two people who did care passionately about the substance of the law. If you listen to my colleague Yale Kamisar talk about Miranda, you will also see passion. Also, no. But a student can't really know enough, really, to know about whether mailing or effective on receipt and effective on mailing, or whether the right to privacy ought to be recognized in California. I mean, that can't really be the topic of something they care about. And so asking them to write a memo about that is almost necessarily inviting them to engage in a process that's distant and imitative and trying to do it the right way and somewhat inauthentic. How about briefs? Now, briefs, in my experience, actually are much better device for teaching people to come closer to the second model than writing memos, and I was thinking about why that's true. One reason is that they do care about something here. One thing they care about is whether they win or lose. But they also care in writing a memo whether they get an A or a B or a D. And that's not exactly the right kind of caring, because that means that what you care about there is whether your performance is going to get graded high or low, not whether what you're saying gets through. But in the brief case, in the oral argument case, as we typically do them, I think there is some actual emotional involvement in whether or not what you're saying gets through, because the person's talking to a judge, he wants to, she wants to be able to persuade and reach the other mind, and not to do that creates an actual felt frustration the way not doing well on something doesn't. And there's an actual person there you're trying to reach, and you're trying to say to them the reason why the state of Ames ought to adopt wait and see. I want you to listen to me. And you actually do want someone to listen to you. Also, I think brief writing introduces the students automatically to the fact that everything or almost everything is arguable in the law, and it's much harder to see this as the brief as really being a platonic ideal than it is the memorandum. The reason being that everything you say that can possibly be countered is going to be countered, and that gets you into the middle of the mess that is actual legal reasoning and legal thinking, which some of our teaching too often denies. I'm going to make a practical comment. I think that the normal pattern of having students write memoranda before they write briefs is wrong. We do it for traditional reasons or for chronological reasons. The memorandum comes before the brief in the law firm or something like that. But I think actually memorandum is much harder to write. I thought this when I was in practicing law. Much harder to write because you have to do so much more. In the briefcase, what you have to do is to make the best case you can on one side and try to anticipate what will be said on the other. In the memorandum case, you have to make the best case on one side, the best case on the other side, come to some kind of judgment as to what you understand, as to what you think about it, some kind of judgment as to whether what you think will be widely shared, some kind of judgment as to how confident you are as to all of that. And that is a very sophisticated piece of work. More sophisticated, I think, as I say, than a brief. And our normal teaching of memoranda, I think, trivializes that form. Well, how can you, I'm still on the question, what is there that law students can care about enough, can actually care enough about enough, so the kind of writing that I talk about as my expressive model too can actually go on, in which we can hope to do it? Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the legal imagination. In that book and course, I try to address this problem by making the students' experience of law school their actual anxieties and uncertainties about what they're doing and who they're becoming, the subject of their conscious attention. That is something they do care about, and not all of them anyway, but a lot of them care about. Being in law school is stressful and anxiety-producing for almost everybody, and to ask them to reflect on that experience is the at least gives you access to something they care about. And the idea upon which I proceed is part is that that can become the subject of their writing partly because they care about it, but it also can become the subject of their writing in a different way. That is, that the writing they learn to do can be a way of addressing that problem, not merely describing it. That is to say, as they become more and more writers of my type too, and better and better at doing that, more and more expressive, less imitative, more self-confident in their powers, and so forth, the anxieties which are their concern, or their uncertainties which are their concern, diminish, and they feel that they become reduced, sometimes reduced a lot. The focus, if you say, the focus is not, my focus, however, is not just on their emotional condition. There's some people who do that, say, how do you feel, you know, crummy. Great. It's not exactly on that. The focus is on their circumstances as minds and writers, on the nature of the language they're learning to use and its forms, the nature of the occasions on which they can speak as a lawyer. What does it mean to speak a discourse which is structured by the rule form called the legal rule? What does it mean to speak a discourse in which what you can say is largely determined by what other people have said on similar occasions? Is it inherently a kind of cut and paste? What would it mean to have a voice of your own as a lawyer? Or is that just impossible? One can hear certainly stereotyped voices of the trial lawyer for the defense, the trial lawyer for the plaintiff, the stereotyped judge, pick up ALR and read through it and you want to perish on the spot. Is this the world, this the language that they speak? Does this language define life as they're going to lead it? A part of them says, yes, it does. And that means a kind of intellectual and moral death. A part of them doesn't think that's true. And we address the question of exactly what their circumstances really are. What can you say as a lawyer here or there? What kind of materials do you have to speak? What kind of relationship is it possible for you to establish with it? Must you be a cut and paster? Is that what this lawyer did in this case, or that judge did in that case? Or can this material be a language in which you can speak what you think in your own way? What's the nature of the language? What's the nature of your relationship to it? And what does this mean about the nature of the profession you're engaged in and the course of life in which you're embarked as an individual at a level of ethics, politics, and the like? What does it mean to become a lawyer as I've defined it? Well, it'd be easy to see that as very negative terms, and a lot of our students feel that they're very upset by what they think they're becoming. The question I put to them is, can you make it make becoming a lawyer for you something different from that, something which you can have pride and satisfaction, in which you're confident about who you are and who you're becoming. Now, my topic is literature and the teaching of writing. And this is the point where literature comes in at least three different ways. First, literature can provide a way of establishing a sense of the range of things which people are able to say and do with language, the whole range of things in which law is likely to be felt by the student to be only a tiny little segment, and not only a tiny segment, but dry, rule-bound, repetitive, and the like. In other words, I use literature as a way of kicking the student in the pants and saying, look, you're going to commit yourself to a life in which you're going to sound like a lawyer or a judge all your life, and when you could talk this way or that way or this other way, what are you doing? Now, I think there's an answer to that, but they don't necessarily know that. You could say that I use literature as a way of defining what it is the law leaves out, what's left out of the universe of discourse of the law that is available to at a personal level. What that means to the student is, what part of myself do I leave out when I practice law? What part do I leave at home with my family when I go into the office? What part do I bring with me? And it's easy to see how you could set this up. You say, ask a student to write a paper about a day in the life of what used to be called the reasonable man. or the adventures of a bona fide purchaser for value, you can read them, or another, if you're really interested in the absolute bottom, you could just read them one of your last examination papers and say, what universe is created here? A universe of stick figures engaged in the most bizarre kinds of unrealistic and unreal relations, named usually in ways which express contempt for them and the enterprise that everybody's engaged in, including these cutesy poo names, which is a way of saying to the students, don't think that these are real people, don't think what you're engaged in is real or important, this is just an analytic exercise on which your whole future depends. But the idea that, I mean, imagine having a legal exam, a law school exam, in which it was possible to imagine a human being in the situation of one party or another. And you can compare this kind of writing with other things, you know, and there's a lot lies around, whatever your taste may be. King Lear, Tolstoy, D.H. Lawrence, you know, it's really all there. The first point really is that literature can be used as a way of defining what the law leaves out as a kind of richness in the world, and richness of the self, and richness of mind and feeling, that you may be denying yourself as you become a lawyer, which just makes explicit what a lot of people feel, anyhow. It can also be used in a related way, somewhat differently. You can say, let's take this particular writer. Now we're not romanticizing literature, as I've just been doing it. Let's take it as actually this little passage, or book, or chapter, or poem, written by a human being. You say, now what is there that's actually so good about that? Why isn't that just cut and paste and stereotype and playing stick figures? What is there that's really good about that? So literature can be, in other words, can be good or bad, right? Nothing necessarily good about a novel. One thing you can do is to use literary excellence as a, what you think of as literary excellence, as a way of defining standards, at least tentatively for your students, by which they can measure their own work. Or you can, more properly speaking, you can make the question of literary excellence in this context, this passage from D.H. Lawrence or Tolstoy, a question for a class discussion and debate, with the understanding that it has a second application, namely, this is excellence in writing. Is there anything like that that I can do myself? You'll find when you do this that the study of literature does not involve the denial of cultural limits, but is actually shows minds facing them in particularly interesting and powerful ways. You think of Achilles in Book 9 of the Iliad, frustrated and spitting because the language of heroic value he has is inadequate to his purposes. Or Huckleberry Finn on the raft after he's refused to turn in Jim and comes back to the raft and says, I know I'd done wrong and I felt so low down, you know. There is a mind coming that is broken really by its culture, and you can study both what Huck does and what Twain does as responses to restricting and limiting language and culture. In other words, as emblems of maybe what lawyers could do with their restricting and language and culture, or what you now, students, think of as restricting about your language and culture. In other words, literature, the comparison with literature is at first depressing to the student because it makes law seem awfully limited and narrow, and it activates and makes public feelings that people all have, or most of them have anyway, about becoming lawyers. But upon further examination, you can begin to discover excellences in writing of a literary kind that may actually, one dimly hopes, may actually be something you can attain, or something like it, you can attain as a legal writer. Not only that, the more you study the forms of legal speech, the occasions for legal speech, their topics and the ways of doing it, you may discover not only that law is not so much that law is a spectrum in this wide sea of wonderful other forms of expression, which is dry and dull and so forth, but actually that law affords the occasion for certain kinds of speech which can be authentic to the individual, which are not otherwise available. That law, in fact, structures conversation in a particular way on essential topics, because one thing we're always talking about is what justice should require in this case, how the power of the state should be employed, and if that's not an important question, I'd like to know what is. Not as an analytic matter, but as it really applies to people, to connect, an opportunity to connect, as very few are able to, the ideal and the real, the particular and the general, to translate the stuff of ordinary life, the anger or pain or greed or envy or hatred that your client brings into your office, right? confusion and distress into something else, into a structured conversation in which the presence of some other person who's also suffering from disturbance or pain or loss in one way or another is also reflected in some kind of whole universe made. Literature comes in at the second stage, that is, by suggesting ways to expose and define possibilities for speech in our own work that we're actually culturally habituated to deny. For example, you take Robert Frost's famous remark about poetry in his essay, The Constant Symbol. He says, There are many things I have found myself saying about poetry, but the chiefest of these is that it is made of metaphor. Saying one thing and meaning another. Saying one thing in terms of another. The pleasure of ulteriority. Right? Well, now, that really describes exactly what we do. Exactly what we do. Every law case, every brief we make, every contract is a translation from one level of experience to another, one level of language to another. Here you have the person in your office bitching and complaining about what those bastards did to him, right? That bitching and complaining about what those bastards did to him becomes not a Sistina Royal, but becomes an elegant form that is not merely elegant, but is a way of connecting that voice with another voice who cannot talk to each other, and connecting them in a way in which everybody is at some level concerned necessarily with the question whether and how that community is to be established and maintain itself. The law connects the particular and the general in a way that is very rare. I mean, one of Sir Philip Sidney, the great Elizabethan poet, said that trouble with philosophy is that it's all ideas and abstract. And the trouble with history is it's just a bunch of data. What connects the individual and the general? The poem. What connects the individual and the general? The law. Every case you have is a particular case, but it's a particular case that will always be spoken about in general and not particular terms. Similarly, your generalities will never remain mere generalities. They're empty at that level. Only law professors worry about that. They become real to you only in the context of a particular case. How about storytelling? What is there that's so great about the way that Tolstoy tells the story of War and Peace? As you dwell on that and think about it, another side of your mind should start up another movie screen which says, well, now, what do I do that's like that and not like that? Actually, you do, as lawyers, as law students, and we as teachers in different ways, tell stories all the time. And the art and difficulty and complexity of telling a narrative which is never wholly true, never wholly false, striking a balance between them, which has an appropriate beginning, middle, and end, which moves to a conclusion which seems right, given the instincts and cultural presuppositions with the story which the narrative triggers, is a problem which is in which we are really situated very similarly to the literary artists whom we admire. Similarly, one will find that one of the great things about a particular work is its capacity to give a place in a single whole to contrary or opposite tendencies, contrary or opposing voices, to multiply points of view and expand your moral understanding that we live in a world, not just of you and others, but a world in which people are truly differently situated and are entitled to equal respect. That question is also presented whenever we write. Or what you admire in a particular work is the way a particular cultural tradition is transformed by irony or mockery, transformed by improvement, transformed by being blended with another. Walt Whitman wants to write a poem to his muse. What do you do when you write a poem to a muse? To a skylark, to a nightingale. Not Walt Whitman. There he is out there on the end of Long Island, surrounded by seagulls, writing a poem to a mockingbird. Or you find that what you admire in a particular literary work is the capacity of the writer to create character, a sense of character and relations between people. You do that too, for well or ill, when you write as a lawyer. The point of it all, if I can sum it up in a phrase, would be to say that the law student, at the end of the process I'm envisaging, should be able to look at her own writing, and instead of saying how different this is from writing I admire, how different, how narrow, how constrained, how dry my writing as a lawyer is from the writing I admire, to say how similar it is. What similar opportunities I have as a mind to those of the ones I admire the most, whatever they are, and that means that what you do admire becomes a real question for you to think about individually and collectively. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, very much. I'm certain you have inspired many of us to re-examine what we've been up to and resolve to bring the poet out of us and into our work and into that of our students. Professor White is not able to be with us past about 4 o'clock, and I may get lynched by Helene and her planning committee, but I would like to use about 5 minutes with your cooperation in hustling back quickly to the school. I'm certain there are one or two of you who would like to make an observation or a question. Well, we have Jim here.
I answered all their
questions. Yeah, I see. All right. Well, in that case, we'll go on back to IIT. Thank you.
Oh, my God.